Mackenzie, baby boy.
Lamar, baby boy.
There you go. On theme with the movie. God. Yep. And yeah, it's one of my favorite lines. Patrick. So warm-up question for today. I feel like we talked about this. Is it's too easy if you say, hey, which ex would you erase from your memory if you could? Because yeah. I feel like most of us wouldn't. You kind of learn from every relationship. Not all of us. I'm sure there's some people that would, but you learn from every
couple of my exes didn't experience. Learn from their relationships, but you know.
You want to call them out while we're here? Lay down some first and last names, cities.
Right. Okay. Some addresses, some social handles.
So I wanted to make a little more sense for the cold open this week. And I want to know if you could have your mind wiped of the memory of a film so that you could hypothetically watch it again for the very first time, what movie would you go with?
This is so fucking hard. I mean, one, I'm really bad at these kinds of things, as we have well established. But two, like, there's so many ways you could go with this. You know, you could go with the route of, I want to have this first experience because it was so glorious, or I want to see, what did I think was going to happen? Like, say, a mystery or a thriller or something where there's a big spoiler.
Yeah, like a
what
surprise, like a sixth sense or something.
Like, what did I think was going to happen? Yeah. It's easy to go back and be like, I saw that coming, but did I really? So I think there's a few like that, maybe. But if I think about just the joy of watching something the first time and just being like, holy shit, that was so good. And it just, I don't know, made you light up from the inside or whatever. There are two that come to mind off the bat, which is Harry Potter, of like seeing this dream of your books that you love and like this world that you have only imagined one way just become manifest and real. And that first one of like Hogwarts looking like Hogwarts, and it just,
so you would want to like, you would want to see the first Harry Potter after having read, because all the books were all the books out by the time the first movie came out, just some of them.
No,
right?
Not all, but the first one was, and several were actually at that point, but not all. And so yeah, I would want to have read the first book but see the first movie and like have that experience of seeing that probably come to life would be, I think, would be one of my favorites. I think some of the others would be more about like the mystery of it all, or the like, did I read it all the right way?
What
you
was
know?
Your other one? Yeah.
I think like Saltburn would be interesting to see again. Ooh. On the first try. I was kind of thinking
you can rewatch
that.
The bathtub scene whenever you want to. You know, that's streaming somewhere.
I just wonder if I would have the same reaction. You know what I mean? Like, I just, it was a lot to take in a short period of time. And then actually a third one came into mind was Oppenheimer. Because if I think about Oppenheimer, I cannot make myself go watch that again. You know what I mean? Like, that was so heavy. That was so intense. It was so good. But I do not have the mental or physical energy to go watch that again. It's going to take me several years, I think, personally. So, but would I want to see it again and like have that first experience again, especially in theaters? Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. That one, I noticed it felt a little shorter the second time that I watched it because I knew the pacing. And I think that was when I rewatched it for the pod. And I was just floored by how quickly everything moves. There's not a moment of silence in that film except for the key moment of silence. And then
I can't remember if I rewatched it for the pod because it was so close. We did it pretty quickly.
Yeah. That was my second watch through. And I was going to say, in regards to Saltburn, cue any listeners who are listening for Eternal Sunshine but have not seen Saltburn that are now YouTubing Saltburn bathtub scene. That's a fucking mistake. You don't want to do that.
Don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do that. Yeah. Whoa. Oof. Yeah. Spoiler warning. Do not do that. Okay. So I answered with a minimum of three, and there are actually more options if you ask me. La La Land comes to mind, for example. Yeah. Anyway, but I digress. What can you pick? Well, one, can you pick one? Like, can you pick one?
I think I can. I think I can, because I'm going for one of the categories you said, which was like the film that just blew you away with how spectacular it was the first time you saw it. With that in mind, I think I would go with Jurassic Park.
Oh, that is so good. That is a good one.
Experience of that the first time you see it, and
especially
seeing dinosaurs
theaters,
for the first time on like in that capacity on the big screen done well, just mind blowing.
The best way to do it, though, and I think I can't remember if I told y'all this when we did that app, but I would want to rewatch that for the first time at Red Rocks, the way that I told y'all. So they do movies on the rocks over the summer at Red Rocks, and I got to see Jurassic Park there the first season that they replaced the screen. So it was like an even better, like bigger screen. That is the most glorious way to watch that movie. You almost can't ever enjoy it the same way ever again. But if that was your first watch, oh my God, that was incredible. That was incredible. That's such a good choice.
Thank you. I guess the other option would be to not have it be the first Dinosaurs I saw on film, but to see it now after all these shitty sequels have come out and watching it as a prequel. That Alan Grant guy from that last really bad one, he's in another. Oh, okay. He's in the prequel. Cool.
But it still holds up. That's, I mean, we talked about this in that episode, but whatever. Anyway, like the actual, the quality of the film holds up. I feel like you could totally watch it now as a prequel and it'd still be really good. So
thanks for
playing. Shit. Now I'm going to be distracted the whole time we talk about this. Just thinking about more movies.
80 other options. Yeah, I know.
Okay, let's roll. Welcome back to We Drink and We Watch Things. I'm Mackenzie.
I do not remember my name.
That happens with this movie. Yep. That one's Lamar. Don't let him tell you otherwise.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And we are continuing our fun Love Stinks month in response to February. You know, who needs a Valentine's Day and a Valentine's month when you have a Love Stinks month? So our next entry is a good one for this topic. Whew, Eternal Sunshine of a Spotless Mind. So what are we drinking? Do you remember? It's okay. Do you need me to do it?
I think I should have mementoed myself and like written it on my arm. But yeah, this is sort of a spin on a mind eraser, which can be drank as either a shot or as a mixed drink, I found out from Skylar. As always, at Craft World made this for us. So it's a little bit different. We're going to use tequila in this. So 2 ounces of Reposado, 2 ounces of Mr. Black or any coffee liqueur you have. If you want to use Kahlua, I'm not a big Kahlua guy. And then Mr. Black 2 ounces
is the preferred method.
Yeah, it's closer to actual sort of cold brew coffee liqueur.
Yep.
And then 2 ounces of soda water. So just basically a third of each of those. And you're going to layer it. So you do the coffee stuff at the bottom. Then you do the reposado. And then you do the soda water on top. Mine was actually in a pretty good. The problem was we started, you know, getting ready to record a while ago. But you can see that it is layered. So you can stir it up. I think for the shot, you're supposed to like drink it through a straw as quick as you can. Did you stir yours up?
Yeah. So your girl didn't follow directions. I just threw all that shit in a shaker and threw it in the glass.
Well, I was going to drink this through a straw, but then I took a sip and I was just getting the coffee stuff at the bottom. And I don't want to drink, you know, 2 ounces of soda water after I get all the good stuff. So who needs to hydrate?
It's so very good like this. So you just shake it up, buttercup. Okay, that's what I recommend.
Also, my straw was being really noisy in the opening, so I'm going to stop using that. So anyway, this is called Blank Slate, a name coined by Mackenzie herself. And again, a spin on both the movie and on the mind eraser cocktail. Usually that's made with vodka instead of tequila is the main difference.
That's true. All right. Cool. Is it shaken up? Are you ready?
Oh, it's shaken.
Okay. Cheers.
Cheers.
Yeah. Just for a quick behind the scenes moments for y'all. Every time we're developing these cocktails, it turns into a mile-long text thread, which is lovely. But Mackenzie had a rough fucking week, so I contributed the name, and I checked the fuck out. And so then I also got the recipe, and I didn't read it at all. I just threw all the shit in there, and it came out great. I'm very happy with it, but I did not follow instructions.
Yeah, I would have let my, I was honestly going to try it as a shot and then additionally do it as a cocktail during the episode, but we found out the last time we recorded, maybe shots at the start of episodes during double features are not that smart, because I was a mess during Gone Girl.
We were a little like slap happy in Gone Girl for sure. Mm-hmm. Plus, we enjoy that movie, and so we were like, this is great. Anyway, it is called We Drink and We Watch Things, folks. Sometimes it's going to happen.
You know why you're here.
You know why you're here, exactly. Okay, well, speaking of why you're here, we're here to talk about this movie. So let's go through some quick basics. Eternal Sunshine of Spotless Mind, 2004, which this like reeks of 2004 to me. If you on rewatch, I was like, I am feeling the 2000s of it all, which we will talk about later. It's almost, it's like, it's this nostalgia for me.
I wrote down that it looks like, at least early in the film, anything that's not in the dream state, it looks like it was filmed on a Polaroid camera. And I don't know if that's a product of the time, but also the director's style. But if you look at some of the frames early on, I'm like, this just looks like Polaroids in motion. So that, yeah,
you know, Polaroids are back too. So, we can
every
test it out.
You go to.
It is kind of fun. I just took a bunch this weekend, although technically it wasn't a Polaroid, but it's one of those things that's become like Kleenex. I digress. Anyway, it was a Fujifilm, whatever. So 2004. It is 8.3 out of 10 on IMDb and 92% from critics and 94% from audiences on Rotten Tomatoes. So, like, again, pretty universal acclaim. I think it's very well received. I wonder if that would hold up if it came out today. That's one of the things I kind of want to talk about later, because I think this is very well received at the time.
If this would have gotten a Best Picture nom had it come out today when there are 10 nominees, because I had read that this was the last film to get a screenwriting Oscar to win, but not to even be nominated for Best Picture. It hasn't happened since, and I think some of that is 10 nominees, but I thought that was interesting. I do, however, have a little bit of trivia for you if you're up for it.
I love a trivia game. Let's do it.
I love a trivia game. So, as I said, last motion picture to win a screenwriting Oscar but not be nominated for Best Picture. So I'm going to give you some clues, and I want to see if you can name the other Best Picture noms from that year, including the winner. And here's your clues. I'm going to give you the actors slash most probably recognizable names in these films from 2004. So one has Johnny Depp. One has Paul Giamatti. I feel like that's the easy one. One has Leo. One has Jamie Foxx, and one has Clint Eastwood. Can you name those 2004 movies that were nominated for Best Picture in 2005?
2005?
Yeah.
Johnny Depp. Isn't that Pirates of the Caribbean?
Not nominated for Best Picture. I would start with the Paul Giamatti one. I feel like that's the easiest one. Name a Paul Giamatti film that got nominated for Best Picture in the early 2000s.
Early 2000s, Best Picture.
I guess
Sideways?
Mid-2000s. Yes, Sideways is the first one. I think the next easiest is probably Jamie Foxx. So early career Jamie Foxx.
Ray.
Yes. Next one would probably be Clint Eastwood. And this was the winner, actually.
Oh, God.
This one Best Picture.
Oh, and he of course has had a bazillion of these, but he had the one where, is it the same year as Hilary Swank? It's the
it's that movie, yes.
It's Million Dollar Baby, isn't it?
Yes, yes. Yeah. Okay, so you got two left. Leo is a little tougher because he had a lot of Best Picture nominees, but 2005?
And the Johnny Depp one is different too, so.
Johnny Depp is probably the hardest one because I didn't remember this. You probably do. I don't think I've ever seen this one.
What is 2005?
Yeah, and I think you've referenced it on the pod before, but I've never seen it.
Finding Neverland.
Yes. Nice.
Yes. Yes. I love that movie. So
I know
because
we talked about it during one of the, what was the one we did with the Christmas where it was Dickens writing Christmas Carol? What was
The Man Who Invented Christmas.
Yeah. I think we compared it there of like similar. Yep. Okay. You got one left. It's the Leo movie and there's a lot to choose from, but which Best Picture nom was 2005?
He got snubbed for Best Actor, didn't he? It was, Aviator.
I mean, that happened a lot. Yeah, it was Aviator. Nice job, dude.
Aviator. Yeah. Yeah.
You went 5 for 5. Well done.
Did I go 5 for 5?
You had one. You said Pirates of the Caribbean, but that was the only thing, wrong response you gave. So nice job.
But he got nominated. I don't even actually know if it ever got nominated for Best Picture. It was that he got nominated for Best Actor, but he didn't win. That was, I think, was what it was. I think that's what I was mixing it up with. But anyways. Okay. Yeah. We love
it.
Nice
little detour there. I'll try and throw some more trivia in. I know how you like it.
We love a trivia. Okay. Well, maybe you have some nuggets for these guys. So we've got a bunch of cast and crew for y'all. So director here is Michel Gondry. Michel being like a French dude, Michel, so don't get it twisted. And he did The Science of Sleep and Be Kind, Rewind. He's also directed a lot of other stuff, but probably the only things that you've heard of. But I haven't seen either, actually. And I thought I had, and I went and like looked at them a little bit closer, and I haven't.
I've seen both. Be Kind, Rewind is definitely worth watching. It's just a fun concept. I don't know if you remember the trailers, but it's Jack Black and Mos Def, and they work in like a VHS store, and they wipe all the tapes by accident or something, so they have to remake all the movies themselves. So it's them
making the summary and like I was like, I don't remember this
version of Ghostbusters or Alien. And I don't remember much about it, but I do remember being entertained and thinking it was very cute. Science of Sleep, I didn't like as much. That one, I think, was the immediate follow up to this, Eternal Sunshine. Yeah. And it got a little too artsy fartsy for its own good. And I hear that, I mean, based on the experiences of the people in this movie, Michel Gondry can be a little difficult to work with. And he's very particular, but also wants to improvise and sort of chaotic. So I think he might have had a little bit of an ego thing going into Science of Sleep because I didn't think that one was as good.
So he is Clementine is what I'm hearing here.
He's not a concept, man.
Chaotic.
He's just a girl trying to get his peace of mind or whatever.
Okay, we're going to get there. We're going to get there. I have thoughts. Okay. But our writers here, so he obviously is one of the writers. This is part of his concept. Another one is Pierre Bismuth, and he helped define this story. This was kind of a result of a conversation between the two of them. So he gets kind of a more of a story credit here. And then Charlie Kaufman contributed to like the actual screenplay as well. So we've got several contributing writers, story developers here.
I found the story of how this came to be really interesting and some of the conflict involved of Pierre Bismuth. Essentially just came up with the concept. He just said, yeah. Him and Michelle were friends and he was an artist. And he said, I have this idea about what would it be like if you got a postcard in the mail that said one of your exes has erased you from their memory. How would you react to that? That's basically all Pierre contributed, if you believe Charlie Kaufman. So Michel Gondry loved that concept, fleshed out the rest of the story, gave it to Charlie Kaufman to start working on the script. You know, years later, Charlie Kaufman will still say, I don't even think Pierre Bismuth should be in the credit. Like, he literally came up with an idea and we did all the work. So he doesn't like that they sort of share this this writing credit.
This credit with them, yeah.
But the other thing I thought was cool was Charlie Kaufman almost quit the project entirely because a little movie by Christopher Nolan came out during the middle of the writing process called Memento, which we already referenced once earlier. And he went, they're too similar. No one's going to want to see our movie when this is already coming out. So he almost quit. Thankfully, he didn't. We have this masterpiece.
Yeah. And I think that says a lot about how films turn into something else than you think they are when written on the page. Because if you were to actually compare Memento and this to each other, they're so different other than being based on, memory issues, right? Yeah. And like, but it is not at all the same viewing experience, not even close. Right. And so it's awesome, that they powered through and made this movie anyway, because I think it's just a totally different experience. All right, our major cast and crew here, Mr. Jim Carrey, of course,
He's been in stuff. Yeah, he's been in some stuff.
He's been in a few things, just a couple things. I think the thing that's fun about him is that, like, this is him in one of his early departures from what he has been known for, I should say, his typical role, not his Ace Venturas of it all. I personally really like his Truman Show.
And even that, he's a little whimsical in that. He's not his typical, goofy self, but this feels like much more of a departure than that, even though I think he did get a nomination for that one, right?
I think he did. I'm actually just looking it up because I was trying to see if he got nominated for any of those. I thought he might get nominated for Truman Show, or even Cable Guy might have gotten a nod at like Golden Globes and stuff like that. I can't find it quickly.
I think that movie was underappreciated in its time. We don't have to go on a whole tangent, but Cable Guy I feel like was reviled when it came out, and now in recent years everyone's like, it's so good. So
rewatched it. I have that time experience and I still mentally feel like it's terrible, but Skylar tried to watch it the other day and I like aggressively made him turn it off. I was like, I do not want to watch this. But I agree, I've heard from
you. You didn't even make
really
him turn the movie off, you just made him turn off the television. You were like, no, turn it off, like, you're not watching anything, you lost your privileges,
you have been punished, you do not get to watch anything. Exactly. But this is one of Jim Carrey's early departures. And then the other one that he did, I'm trying to remember, it's where he's playing the guy from SNL.
Oh, you're talking about Andy Kaufman. Yes, Man on the Moon.
But it's called like Jim and Andy, or Andy and Jim, I thought. Or was it?
Man on the Moon is the movie he was in playing Andy Kaufman. I think there might have been a documentary or something called Andy and Jim that's covering the similarities between them. Yeah.
Got it. That's what I was thinking of. It was a documentary I thought was really interesting. I remember that. That's what it was. Okay. Yeah,
and I think he got, a lot of people say he got snubbed for that one too, because Janelle and I play this game called Movie Grid. You can play it online. It's free, but it's just like filling in categories every day. They give you three actors and then three categories. And one of them sometimes will be film that was nominated for any Oscar. And it was Jim Carrey. And I went, oh, Man on the Moon, he died. And turns out he didn't get any nominations for that. So yeah, shocking.
Yeah. I mean, he's underrated because I think people, and there, this is like a whole separate conversation around the philosophy of it all, but like comedy is very hard. It just looks easy. And he is known as being a comedian, obviously. And so people think it's just easy and it's not, it's really hard. And if you interview a lot of comedians, like I think of Melissa McCarthy gave an interview about this. She was like, every time I played a dramatic role, it's been so much easier than to try and make things consistently funny and give the same performance. So yeah, I think he just has deserved some acknowledgement for some of those roles for sure.
Yeah. He even said this was the role that is closest to how he is in real life when he's not like, quote unquote, turned on, when he's switched over to his on-screen personas. Mm-hmm. He said this Joel in this film is like Jim Carrey at a one when he's just hanging out in his house.
Yeah. Well, he's like an average guy, you know. Yeah. This character is not anything like Flash playing fascinating, but he's very relatable. And I think that's what's interesting is like a lot of these superstars are perceived one way or the other. And they're like, ultimately, at the end of the day, just people.
They're just people.
You know, they're just people. So maybe he's boring at home. And you do you, Jim. Have a great time. All right. Also, Miss Kate Winslet, who is just a gem and has done so many things and is such a badass. And this is also just, this is again, like her post Titanic departure from this kind of typecasting that she had, you know, been lumped into. And I love that for her because I think it's a hard right turn. She gets to show how different she can be. And it opens up in a future state a lot of different roles for her. But one of the ones she's nominated for later is really intense. The Reader is really well done. Mm-hmm. I also really like It's a Random One, The Dressmaker. She does a great job in The Dressmaker.
What other professions has she been in movie titles? I guess reader's not really a job, but it could be. You could get paid to do that.
I was going to say it wasn't a job. She was learning how to read, actually. It's a whole thing.
Spoilers. Okay.
But yeah, I was gonna She's done everything.
Another lesson that I've learned from that movie Grid Game is when Kate Winslet pops up. It turns out I haven't seen very many Kate Winslet films. So I dove into her IMDb. It turns out I've seen 3 Kate Winslet films in history. And it is...
What?
Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Titanic, and A Kid in King Arthur's Court. I'll repeat that. A Kid in King Arthur's Court. Those are the 3 Kate Winslet movies.
I have so many questions. I also feel like we need to have a sidebar conversation wherein I go through the entire fucking list and go, are you kidding me? One time after another.
Am I fired? From
you're a little bit fired. Yeah. Life of David Gale. Finding Neverland's a great one. Let's see. Fox and the Child is actually a pretty good one. How to Lose Friends and Alienate People. I'm surprised you haven't seen that. The Reader, Revolutionary Role, Contagion, The Holiday. This is like a very accessible movie. We're like 0-10 at this point.
I verified this myself.
Enigma, Quills. Nope. Jesus Christ. You're broken. You're broken. Sorry, and Kate. I can't fix sorry, it. Kate. I can't fix it. Oh, my God.
That'll be my like New Year's resolution next year is to watch.
You know what we're going to do? We're going to do a Kate Winslet month is what's going to happen out of some due respect that must be paid. Jesus.
My one ask is that we do A Kid in King Arthur's Court.
Because that's the one you already
know. I don't even know how much she's in that because the main character is the kid from Rookie of the Year, like the old baseball movie. So the child actor, I don't even remember Kate Winslet being in the movie. So I can't remember if she's a child and she's in it for the whole thing or if she's only in it for like a little bit. I don't remember.
I love that the one you've seen is maybe the one I haven't seen. And it also is supposed to be really bad. It's like got a 4.7 on
here.
Even
as a kid, I was like, this is not a good film. Yeah.
Well, we can put you on some like Sense and Sensibility classics, some Hamlet, perhaps. We'll figure it out. But holy shit. Okay, we got to move on because I'm so alarmed. Elijah Wood is in this, makes a brief appearance as kind of a little brat. But I haven't seen this in so long that it was like little reminders. You sort of vaguely know who the characters are, but who's playing them, you know, like kind of comes into view and you're like, oh shit. So Elijah is Patrick of Lord of the Rings fame. Wilfred is one of his one-off ones. He's also recently been in Yellow Jackets. If you're watching Yellow Jackets, he's been
good in that. Yeah. I feel like he was making a very early point between this and Sin City of like, I am not going to be typecast as Frodo for the rest of my life. I'm going to go play the creepiest characters possible. Yeah. Weirdos.
He also like didn't do anything for a hot minute. He was just like, I quit. I'm done.
Well, he did he did that animated movie 9, which I thought was pretty good. And when I was younger, I didn't realize that was him in it, but I liked that one a lot. And I think The Faculty was even before Lord of the Rings. I think he was already in The Faculty by the time he got the Frodo role, but I like that one, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, I like when he shakes it up later, but I also felt like when you play such an iconic role like that, it genuinely is hard to see the actor as somebody else. It's not even his skill. It's not that. It's just like, fucking, hey, Frodo. Like, I don't know what to tell you. That's how I see you from now until eternity. Anyways, Mark Ruffalo, another one that is in here in a very young form. It's funny. He plays Stan. He obviously has gone on to do many, many wonderful things, including but not limited to Spotlight, which I love his turn in Spotlight. To me, a snubbed Oscar to some degree. It was a really good category that year, I will say, but so good. Foxcatcher and Marvel. He's been in, obviously, playing Hulk and things of the like. Lots of other things.
Incredible Hulk. Yeah, after... Eric Banana and Edward Norton. There was an interesting story that I never knew about Mark Ruffalo, that prior to this role, he was supposed to be Joaquin Phoenix's character in Signs with Mel Gibson, like the Shyamalan vehicle. And he got a brain tumor and had to be operated on, had partial facial paralysis, couldn't do Signs, and this was like his comeback. Like, he healed, and obviously he's recovered completely now, but this was his first thing. But I mean, his career still has skyrocketed since then.
But that's why his like little lip thing, if you ever noticed that, is from that. Yeah. But no, this is one of his first big roles back, and he's really funny in this, but he's brief, you know. I think he's done a lot of other great things. He does a really fun one that I liked that's like kind of a, I don't know, not necessarily a guilty pleasure, but like a smaller indie film that I liked, which was Begin Again with Keira Knightley and the guy from Maroon 5, whose name I'm going to forget right now. Adam
Devine? No, that's the actor. Adam
Levine.
Levine. So it's partial credit. I get rhyming bonus. Yeah.
You do. But anyways, he and Keira Knightley's characters are musicians and composers, and they make an album together, and it's like, and they actually do the music together in the film. It's really cool. It's cute. That's cute little one.
If you want another fun fact about Mark Ruffalo that isn't on IMDb?
Of course.
So I told Janelle this. I took a bunch of acting classes in college, but I took one specifically that was acting for film. So it was learning how to be on camera and like the differences between being on stage versus being on camera. And
which is wildly different. Theater kid can attest.
Yes. Lots, much more subtle. And we actually, one of my first ones that I did was a scene from this movie where I played Mark Ruffalo's character, and the girl opposite me was the Kirsten Dunst character. So we did.
Okay, which part of the scene?
It was the very last conversation they have. So I won't spoil before we get there, but it's the final scene between the two of them.
Okay, we're going to dig in, and I want to hear your best impression when we get there. That is a fun fact. We love a fun fact off screen. And speaking of, Kirsten Dunst is in this, and she plays Mary, who causes a lot of ruckus in this one. She's done a lot of things. She's been in Spider-Man, Interview with a Vampire, Bring It On, Virgin Suicides, Crazy Beautiful. Like,
I was
going to
say, this
things.
Is the fourth Kirsten Dunst film that we have covered.
We have done Bring It On,
Marie Antoinette. What was the other one? She was in...
we talked about her.
Hidden Figures. She's not as the main character in that, but she's in it. Yeah.
She is in that. Well, and also, I feel like that opens up a whole can of worms. So we should be like, whose films have we done the most?
Yeah, I feel like it's probably going to skew towards some Tarantino guys, just because we did four. Anytime we do four movies by the same director, there's probably going to be some overlap. But
we also have to like disqualify Samuel L. Jackson because he's in everything, and then move on. It's a good time. So she's in this. She plays a very interesting character. We'll get there. And then Tom Wilkinson, Howard, or Dr. Mirzwak, whatever.
Mirzwak, yeah.
Why do people purposely choose the most redonkulous names in a fictional feature film that I then have to say? Anyway, I'm calling him Howard. And he was in the Full Monty, if you didn't know, Full Monty fame. And then I picked a couple like dark horse ones, because this is a man who's been in 1,000,001 things, and he's incredible Yeah, great character actor. We love him. But I shared a couple of my faves, and I welcome you to do the same. I really loved him in Snowden, mm-hmm. and I also really loved him in The Debt, if you haven't seen okay. that.
I liked him in Batman Begins. He's one of the early villains in that one with the Christian Bale Batmans. And then he's it's not the best Guy Ritchie film. It's probably, if there's what, six of, not counting like Sherlock Holmes and those other, but the typical Guy Ritchie movies of Snatch, Lock, Stock. If there's five of those, this is probably like the fourth best. So it's not great, but Rock and Rolla. He is the main, I guess, villain in Rock and Rolla. One of Tom Hardy's first film roles. So worth watching if you're a Guy Ritchie fan, but it's mid at best.
I was going to say it's one of the more mid ones, yeah. but I basically will watch anything that Guy Ritchie does all day long. All right, homies, quick plot summary, and then we're going to get into spoiler territory. So when their relationship turns sour, a couple undergoes a medical procedure to have each other erased from their memories forever. What a decision. And a really fun concept, to be fair. I do think it's an interesting concept for a film.
It is. I feel like if you overthink at the end of the day, a company that's making money off this probably wouldn't give a shit about consequences. But if you overthink, I'm like, this can't be the first time that this has happened where an ex has found out that they've been erased and wanted to react to it in some way, right?
Do you know how overthinking I got about this?
Yeah.
I was like, what is the FDA process for the approval of this procedure? I was like, there's no way that this is so, that it is outpatient, that it is in your home, that this person could even, like, I was down a fucking rabbit hole with the overthinking. So yeah, hard agree. A lot of potential holes here.
They could have like zoomed out at the end, and it turns out this whole movie takes place. The big twist is it takes place in some country with very little government oversight. And like, I'm not going to stereotype anywhere, but you know what one came to your brain. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, kids. Well, we're tiptoeing around it. So let's just go there. Turn around. Don't drown. It's spoiler time.
Oh yeah.
So this shit on rewatch, cause it's been a minute. I was like, dang. This is one, it's so 2000s, like yeah. I was saying. Two, the way that it's shot, really interesting, fascinating to me in a lot of different moments. Like, it's stylized, it's purposeful, you get it, but it's a choice. Mm-hmm. And the narration that kicks us off is like, what an opener, you know, what an interesting way to start this interaction. And then I think my last takeaway at a very high level is like, fuck, I felt sad immediately. I felt sad so quick. Like, you get to the sad, you hit the sads so quick. And it is almost not quite 2 hours of just the sads. And I thought, how do we like this? At some point right around there, I was like, why do we still love this movie? Like, why was this movie so well received? And you keep watching it and you keep watching it and it sort of starts to come together, but you're still like, shit, this is heavy, man.
It is somber. Like yeah. you said, right off the bat, the tone is set and it doesn't really let up. I wouldn't say there's a ton of happy moments in this. There's a little bit of
there
levity.
There are like a few
funny.
Split seconds. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, like I think this has aged well because the reason it got popular was it was probably a lot of people in, I'm trying to think of, so 2004, I would have been 20. So my guess would be it's people between 18 and 30 that really dug yeah. this right off the bat. It was people who had yeah. been through bad breakups, but saw sort of the depth of this and the concepts that it brings forward. But I think you can see yourself in one of these two roles, and it gets you also thinking about, would you ever do this? And would you end up, like, when you start thinking about the good parts of relationships, as opposed to remembering just the last couple months when you were miserable? I think the difference, though, between something like this and Garden State, which we also all thought was super deep when I was 20 years old, and that one does not hold up as well.
That was a groundbreaking film at that time. We for sure thought that was... Oh,
the soundtrack's still really good, and the movie's not bad. It's just not as deep as we remember it being, guys. But this one, I think, still holds up.
Yeah, this is still a deep film. Yeah, Garden State is not as deep, and it's got a real manic pixie dream girl stereotype that's real bad.
Yeah.
And I will say, caveat this, Clementine's a little bit that, but she's the darker, deeper version of that, right? She's the, like, I don't know, kind of the ugly side speaking to her speech that you teased out earlier, right? Of like, not the ugly side, the real side, right? Yeah. Like, not a concept. That person in Garden State is a concept. And this is an actual person, a real, like, messy person, which is what we actually are and is totally valid.
The concept of manic pixie dream girl, for those that are not familiar, as we've said it a few times, is just sort of this, like, it's a girl that doesn't exist. This person that a lot of males who see films will project onto and be like, she's perfect. Why can't all women be like her? And it's like, because that's not a real fucking person. I've seen all different characters over the last couple decades lumped in with this. Ramona from Scott Pilgrim versus the World gets kind of lumped in, but she's got her own shit too, because I really like that movie. So I give her a pass, but this one. And then actually Janelle put in the heavy lifting and looked it up. And the guy who coined the term manic pixie dream girl actually ended up basing it not on this movie. Cause I asked Janelle last night, I was like, is this the first example of this? And she was like, I don't think she is that. And it turned, you know, is to your point. But the movie that he based it on was Elizabethtown, which came out in 2005. Yeah. So the year after this was the first quote unquote manic pixie dream
girl. Which is also Kirsten Dunst, by the way. So is she our Kevin Bacon? Like, what's happening? Is she our Kevin? It feels like she's this pod's Kevin Bacon. But yeah, that also checks out. And it's, and it is such a stereotype, and it appears on an ongoing basis. But I think that's what I like about Clementine as a character. Like, if we would just want to get into the character analysis of them, I like that Joel feels real, like feels like a normal person. And I like that Clementine feels real, but in a very different sense of like, she's a mess. She's still trying to figure herself out. And I love that she knows herself well enough to know and to say to him, like, I'm just a person out here looking for their own peace as well. Don't assign me the project of yours. Like, that's not my project. Right. And I love her, like, protecting her peace, creating a boundary. Y'all, this was 2004. We didn't really talk about boundaries. We didn't really do this in a healthy way. And she's fucking, that's what she's doing. Like, we're looking at her and going, God, this girl's a mess. But she's actually weirdly together, right? She's like weirdly emotionally together in that she is. And it, I like the juxtaposition of she doesn't present that way, but the things that she's saying and that she's trying to do are actually trying to protect her peace and trying to create boundaries and trying to create healthy relationships while simultaneously acknowledging like who she actually is. You know, she's still a mess. She's still a mess of a person, but she's not going to let herself be treated a certain way. She's not going to necessarily treat other people a certain way. She wants to be who she is and be very upfront about that. And I think that's really likable about her.
I think that a lesson that I've learned as I've gotten older and dated and whatnot, and I think you realize you really need two people who are already sort of independently have their shit together. I was going to say independently happy, like already in a good state, but I think this movie's a little different because both of them have their own shit. Not to say that they're like, Joel doesn't seem super happy to me at the beginning. He just seems like kind of miserable, honestly, but that might just be a state of him just having had his mind wiped, and it's like the day after Valentine's Day. I mean, so I think you learn that lesson as you get older of you don't want to jump into something and just be super codependent right off the bat. So my question for you though was gonna be, I get why Joel likes Clementine and why he is drawn to her, because she is so independent and she's impulsive and she makes him
and
take
we get
risks.
A lot of him saying why too. It helped, like he says what he was intrigued by with her. Yeah.
Out of his comfort zone, taking risks, doing things he wouldn't normally do. What do you think draws Clementine to Joel? I wrote that down. I get why he likes her. Why does she like him? Is he?
I'm so
safe?
Glad you asked, because I have the answer to this.
Okay.
So,
I'm like, I talked to Michelle.
I talked to Michelle. No, I'm kidding. I do think I have the answer to this, but it's entirely supposition. I think she sees him as a grounding force. Stabilizing force. Okay. So I say that because y'all, your girl's been in years of therapy. Okay. So excuse me while I therapize for a second. And one of the many things that I had talked about with my therapist is very similar to the lines of her talk track of like, you have a concept of me. Mm-hmm. You have a vision of me that you have idolized, romanticized, put on a pedestal, whatever it is. And it's not the actuality of me. And I'm just a normal person with flaws and great things also, but definitely flaws, right? And I think what is interesting is that I learned in this process is that people will seek in others the thing that they think is a vacuum in themselves, right? Of like, I need this person to either uplift me, get me out of my comfort zone, make me do things I would never do, or I need this person to regulate me. I need this rein me in, to help me create balance and groundedness and stability. Right. And I think what you could easily say about Clementine is she doesn't feel entirely stable. And a lot of times she's okay with that. But I think she also is aware of it. And that can feel destabilizing. Right. Yeah. And he feels stable and steady and even keel and regulated, I think, to her. So I think she thinks, this is a person who's going to balance me. This is a person who's going to even these scales and make my crazy a little less crazy, but I'm still going to get to be me. And he's like, hey, I'm going to be a little less boring and get this, you know, fun side of me that's living in the dark to come out, because she's going to inspire me to do that.
Yeah, I think you're pretty spot on. It's like opposites attract, but in a very specific way. Just this person is good for me, not because of just like, oh, they make me happy or they buy me things or they take care of me, but just in they're good for me mentally. Like they are what I need. I like that. Okay. I want to backtrack a little bit just to, I love the way the movie's framed. I love that before the opening credits, we get 15 minutes of just this meet cute, which we think at the first time you see this, you think it is a meet cute, right?
You think it's a meet cute, but you think it's a weird meet cute. Like if a meet cute could be branded like stalker-y. To be weird. Yeah. You're like, this is cute, but I feel uncomfortable somehow.
Yeah. I love that it throws you into that. You do get a couple breadcrumbs that I didn't notice until like the third or fourth time I saw this, of when Joel first wakes up, you hear a door slam, and that's the van outside of the people who just wiped his memory. So this is obviously the day after or the morning of what we see at the end of the movie. So I feel like you get a few breadcrumbs, but I love that it jumps from that to we get this awkward Elijah Wood knocking on the window of your car, and he's got very strange facial hair in this.
But yeah.
Just like,
he looks like such a babe, too. Like I just, the fact that he's trying to win her over and like steal her away. You're like, I'm not buying, at least me personally. I was like, I'm not buying it. You're like,
dude, grow a full beard or grow nothing. But we get that awkward. And then it just sort of cuts to Joel crying in his car. And we get these really, again, somber opening credits where they think it's Beck singing over top of it. And then when we cut back, now we're in the past and we're seeing what kind of got us here.
I love two things about this. The Beck of it all, because of course, glorious.
Is there two or three songs on here, right? Or is it just the same song that they used twice?
I think it's two songs. Okay. And he just has such an energy about him. And I like when we insert Beck here, I feel like it's a moment, you know, and I do really love that. But I also noticed and like how long it took to get to those credits, as you said, like of there's so much happening. But I think that's intentional for a number of reasons, including but not limited to the first time you watch it, you don't know like where the line in the sand is exactly and what is happening. And so I think it's a subtle way to make you pay attention to, this is the first time I'm seeing this and it feels like I've been here for 10 minutes and, you know, whatever. And so like maybe making you consider that a little bit more, but not giving it away. I think that was like a small, subtle move that was well done.
Yeah. We talked about that before we started recording today when we were talking about the cold open. And I said, there's some movies where they get better on rewatch, where you pick up on things that you didn't see. And I think this is one of those where it's like, oh shit, now I see this. Now I notice this. So yeah.
This was a really interesting rewatch for me for that reason. Well, two reasons. One, because I got the benefit of some of that, but also some of it I had forgotten. So it had been such a long time that I felt like certain things were kind of a rewatch. Like I kind of forgot about the Howard Mary dynamic, you know, and like I knew something sets shit off later, but I didn't really exactly remember what instigates it and what have you. And
that's another one of the breadcrumbs I wrote down was like, oh, this is kind of a creepy dynamic right off the bat. She's doing like goo goo eyes at him and he's just sort of ignoring her, just like, thank you, Mary, get out of my office, please.
And exactly that. Like, and he also touches her later in a somewhat intimate way in the office. And again, I having forgotten about that aspect, I still noticed it though. I was like, hey, that's weird. Like that feels like a weird way for him to touch her. And it had been so long, it still didn't trigger that. And so like, again, later at the end, I'm like, oh God, that's why, you know, he has this like feigned familiarity with her, at least from what it looks like on this end. And so, yeah, it takes you a minute to like fully appreciate all of that. And I think to your point, this is one that gets more interesting on rewatch in those ways. But I will say some of the shots that we're talking about and some of like the way that it's shot on rewatch is hard and gets kind of old. I think like for me, there were certain things where I was like, I'm kind of over this scene or I'm kind of over the way this is shot. The bright, intense lighting that feels like, and I know this was intentional and I'm not insulting it every single usage, but I think it's a little overused. The like close up dark room, but spotlight shot that is used multiple times in here. And I just felt like that was a little overused. And by like the second or third time it's happening, maybe the third, I'm like, I'm kind of over it.
Yeah, I guess I could see what the director's trying to do, right? Because he's playing with memory and he's reliving these things that he just went through and experienced. So it makes sense that we're seeing the same thing multiple times. But I do hear you that some of the shots in here on rewatch, I was like, this is, again, I don't know Michel Gondry, but like at times it does feel a little full of itself. I appreciate, though, how much the effects are practical, because at one point I wrote down, I can't tell if this is stop motion, if this is some kind of claymation in this scene. I can't tell what is, if there's a green screen involved, but I looked it up afterward and it was like almost everything in this is practical. I think there's a little bit of CG for two scenes, but most of it's practical effects.
Yeah. And I think like actually one of the scenes where that's in place is both really interesting and kind of out of place. And that's like the 50s or 60s-ish rather throwback kitchen scene where he's trying to hide her in his memories at this point, which I think is a really cool concept. I think that's a cool concept that they try to execute throughout, and it becomes this chase. So it turns this thing that could be really oversimplified into a little bit of a thriller in that sense. That's fun. I like that process. And I actually like the scene, but it does stand out as notably different. Is what I would say. Like, he's been trying to hide her in different places. Right. That part's not new. But the aesthetic and the way he's trying to hide her in this scene is so different that it feels almost out of place. It's still very interesting. He's like smaller baby Joel. There's this, you know, his mom is present. There's like the bathwater scene. He's scaled literally down, but he's a human form, but he's supposed to be a baby.
A little bit of forced perspective stuff there, I believe. Because I think that's all practical of just, we're going to build a really big kitchen, or like we're going to have Kate stand really close to the camera while Jim is far away. I will say I'm kind of in agree. I love that scene of him reaching and going, it's ice cream. I love that. And the bathtub or the sink, but
like, sink of him being like, I'm so comfortable. Like, I feel so safe. And you're like, I get it, man.
I wish I had a sink that big, but, I'm in agreement with you of, it does feel like that scene and the one when they're in the woods right before that, and he's doing the thing with his eyes and he's like, oh, there's working gangbusters. Those are the only two where I'm like, oh, this is Jim Carrey getting a chance to be Jim Carrey, as opposed to the rest of the role where he is very reserved. That's where he needs to be a little bit silly. I think it makes the movie better, but I hear you on why it's like, I'm a little over this.
I totally hear you on the tonal shift. And actually, there's another scene, and I'm struggling to place exactly what was happening, but it was him. Oh, they are watching something together. She and him are watching something together, and he starts like doing, they're at the drive-in. They're watching the movie at the drive-in, and they're both doing a voiceover of the film, dubbing it. And it's really good, and it's really cute, and it's a great scene. And it's another like, let's hide you in this memory moment. But it feels goofy. It feels goofier than him as a character. And I wonder, that's where you can like attribute it maybe to the dream state of, this is how I wish this went. This is how I wish I was in this moment. But it's not really dreamy. It's a memory, right? So it's like, are you changing the memory while
maybe
it's
being... Maybe some of that is the impact that Clementine had on Joel over the course of their relationship. Was maybe he did get a little wackier, because at the beginning he says, I don't even talk to girls.
It's true.
Why do I fall in love with anyone who even pays me the least bit? So he's very down on himself, and assuming that this is sort of where he was on day one when he met her. It makes sense that maybe over the course of their relationship, he did get a little sillier and he's willing to put himself out there a little more. So maybe.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, a great call out of like, this is our only exposure to how their relationship actually went, is these memories, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, did they really bring out these great things in each other? And we just didn't get a chance to see it, so it feels a little unbelievable, but maybe it's totally there. I think that's a really good segue into the de-evolution of their relationship, where I think I come down to, like, at the end when they're saying these really hateful things, and, like, one of the things I have in my notes of this scene is so hard to watch, this scene of them talking to each other after they've discovered what has happened, and you're sort of putting the puzzle pieces together, and he's super hurt, she's super hurt, and she comes to him to find him hearing the recording of himself as well, saying these also awful things about each other. And I think that's such a difficult shift and precursor to what actually ends up happening, which is, hey, let's give this another shot, basically. Because that's the last thing they actually remember, right? The thing that they remember in this context is them saying terrible things about and to each other. And for that to be a foundation of, well, maybe we'll give it another shot, you know, because at this point we've lost the good ones. We've lost the good memories. We've lost these, this is where you made me lighter. This is where you made me joyful. You made me goofy, whatever. This is where you grounded me and we had stability and we went to dinner every night and whatever. Like, all those good things that they found in each other, in theory, obviously they ended up a different way. But, like, the only snippet that they are getting at this point is these terrible things that they are saying about each other. And it's really interesting to me that that yields this conversation. And it's awful because it's playing in the background. It's literally the overlaying this conversation, and he's saying horrible things about her. And you're like,
and at this point, they've known each other, in quotation marks for those not on video, for what, 2 days? This go round?
Yeah, so it, like, seems like you just 30, met this person 24 and, yes, to 36 hours.
You fell hard of, oh, there's a connection. This is magical. We've been hanging out for 48 straight hours. But yeah, then for this negativity to come up and you get this sort of bomb dropped, the end is sort of what you make of it. I think some people would take it as a happy ending because it's we want to experience the good stuff and we know that there is something good here, even if we know it won't end happily. Which I guess from a real life perspective of what we talked about in the cold open is I wouldn't erase any of my bad breakups because I appreciate what got me there and I learned from everything. So I guess maybe it's less about will they be happy or will it be different this time and more just like don't try to forget everything you've been through. I don't know. Does that make sense?
It does. It's got me, really ruminating on it because I think of like the next comparison that I make is the mild ass thing that we talked about in that episode. If you don't want to hear a spoiler for Mild Ass, which is an episode we've did, but maybe you haven't seen, fast forward like 30 seconds. Okay. Yeah. So like she knows he's going to die, but she opts into it because she also knows through these conversations with her older self that she has this deep, deep love of him. And it's going to be worth that experience because it is a heartbreak. Don't get me wrong. It's a heartbreak, but I wonder if it does genuinely feel like a different kind of heartbreak, right? It's not deciding that we weren't right for each other. We can't make each other happy. It's I lost you in a different way. And we were very, very deeply happy. This feels a little bit different because it feels like we chose not to be together because we weren't ultimately making each other happy. That's my read on it. And I'm wondering if that's like a universal interpretation of it. Like, what was that your interpretation of it? Or what did you feel like?
I think it is. Yeah. I mean, clearly neither of them likes the other by the end of their relationship. It's not as though it was a one-sided decision.
Well, the only reason I say that is because they make it seem very impulsive, especially on her side, right? They make it seem like if you think about it in the sense of, hey, we had a really terrible fight and I'm super fucking pissed. And if you ask me about him right now, I'm super fucking mad, right? And he does the same thing in response to what Clementine does of like, he's doing this because he's super mad and he's being very reactionary. And I wonder if, are they both in only this reactionary moment and they regret it and that's why? Or did they deeply like not make each other happy and they're just like, we'll give it another shot.
I think it probably hit a wall at some point where they were outgrowing each other or growing apart because we see parts of them being very happy and very content. Mm-hmm. It takes, you know, 45, 50 minutes of the movie to get to that point in the relationship. For the most part, we're just seeing them in the final stages of their relationship where they fucking resent each other like crazy.
Yeah.
Both ways. Again, did you read the original ending or like alternate ending that they didn't shoot for this? What the original game plan was?
I read it, but I don't remember the details. It's like there was another ending with Clementine and she was going to show her after the procedure and what have you. Do you remember it all?
So what I read was, and I don't think they shot this. I don't even think it was in a cut of the script. I think it was just the original ending that Michelle Gondry had pitched to Charlie Kaufman when they were writing it. But it was going to end with essentially Clem going back to see Mary at the hospital.
Oh, and she's done it over and over. It
turns out they've been doing this for decades of like now they're elderly, but they just keep finding their way back to each other, ending up unhappy, wiping their memories again. I feel like that's a worse ending because it's like they're never actually happy.
But I feel like that's the implication here. Like that's the thing that's sad about the ending here. I feel like that's the implication of they're just going to end up back where they were. Now, if we want to flip it, like if you want to consider maybe this is just a hard reset. Maybe this is just a fresh start. And I wonder if that's the philosophical question being posed here, right? Of if you were to erase these memories where things went awry and you were given a second shot at it, could you do it differently? Or is it this fate-based reality of you're eventually going to end up in the same place no matter what? Or do you truly have a second chance? Is that the question?
You truly have a second. Speaking as someone who is currently dating a girl that he dated 15 years ago and broke up, and then granted, we had a decade to mature between the first and second go around.
Sometimes that makes all the difference.
Yeah, these folks had 48 hours, so they're probably about the same people. But yeah, I think that the end where he basically just says, okay, if that's what happens, that's what happens. Like, I'm fine with it. And they just, okay, mm-hmm. That they're sort of ambivalent about it. I did, watching this, had a memory of another movie that we've covered that has to do with sort of like the muscle memory of going back to the places that you associate with your life. Because in this, they keep making their way back to Montauk. And that movie was called Dawn of the Dead 2004. Because the zombies, they all came to the mall.
Nope. Unsubscribe. I did not subscribe to this conversation. I had to get that in here.
Okay, I'll cross that off my notes now.
Absolutely cool. Not. We're not talking about that. I will say though, I think that's real. That part is very cool, actually. The like that she subliminal messages Montauk into him. Mm-hmm. But I think what I do like about this film, even though that it ends in a really, I think it's a really dark way. That's my interpretation.
That's a fair take,
I think it's a very like, this can't end well for a number of reasons, and you're going to just keep doing this to each other. And I think the implication is there's a ton of ways it can go, but it can be like, this is my only option, or I just am going to do what's comfortable, or I'm drawn to you. And it turns out the same way over and over, you know, on a loop like that. All of that feels terrible. But I think what's interesting about the Montauk thing is she's worked that in a way that says like, come back to me. And if you want to interpret that in this kind of romantic way, I think that's the one piece that I'm kind of like, okay, that's kind of romantic or cute or cool. But it feels like a dark ending to me. But I think there are a lot of ways that you can go with this interpretation. How much of his dream state is memory state is reliable, right? Because if you think about the only memories that we see through the whole thing are his. We just know that she has done this procedure. We haven't seen her version of it, right? So what does that exact same memory of their relationship look like in her version of this? And so that is the part of this movie that I find really interesting that you get to think about and ruminate on, of how reliable is this memory that we're seeing, and how much of this is the version he's given himself, and how much of this is Joel, who has come into this film and into this conversation being down on himself, feeling heavy, feeling like less than, and how much of that is this chicken and egg situation of, did this relationship do that to him and make him feel that way? Because that's the first version of him that we see. Or has he always been this way? And that applies to these memories and it colors everything. So I think it's interesting to think about.
I was going to say that the movie is smart enough to call that out. because at one point he's talking to Dr. Mirzwiak in his subconscious, and he says, well, I'm you. You're just projecting whatever your thoughts are into me.
Yeah.
I'm a character in your dream, so I'm just you. Yeah. I think that what you just said, that can apply to Clementine as well. So everything that he's encountering is all his sort of creative mind or his memory or his what he needs to hear from himself. So the whole her the telling him to meet her in Montauk is doesn't really make sense when you think about it.
Right.
It can be a
whole, but it can also inform like him reaching for her. Him trying to find a way to hold on to her.
That's fair. Yeah. The memory of her is sort of telling him to go back to where we met. And I think that just to sort of spin off of that, I wanted to touch on the last 15 or so minutes of this are fucking incredible. Like the scene of them meeting and her again pointing out to him within his memory, quote unquote, of, you know, this is the last thing. After this, we're done. Like, what do we do? And he says, just enjoy it. And from then on, I'm basically in tears for the rest of the movie of just them going through this memory. They have the whole house on the beach filling up with sand and water and him recounting the day and how he bailed on it. Like that through the ending of, you know, this sort of dark and interpretable thing that we've talked about just like gets me every single time.
Yeah, I think it comes back to the part of the philosophy that's about, do we just enjoy the journey?
You know,
mm-hmm. Do we just enjoy each other for the parts that we can enjoy? And you're not perfect and you're not perfect for me even, but this is still a beautiful story to tell, you know? And that's why we're looking at it. Is that why we're looking at it as viewers, you know, because it's still a beautiful story to tell. And so, yeah, I think it's a really thought provoking and heartstring pulling film, if heavy and hard to process sometimes.
And worth rewatching if you haven't seen it in a few years or a decade or so or 20 years.
I highly recommend a rewatch because it's, like I said, if you give it just the right amount of time, you remember bits of it and you don't remember all of it, and it can still feel new. That was at least my experience this time. And
I feel like I want to watch this every 5 or 10 years and see how I interpret it differently, because it's that. And the other one that we had thought about covering this month but didn't make the cut was 500 Days of Summer. I feel like that's kind of similar to this, so it doesn't make sense to do both. But that one, I remember watching it the first time and seeing it completely from Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character's perspective and being like, this is what the way this should have played out. Now when I watch it, I see it from Zooey Deschanel's perspective, and I'm like, she's fucking upfront and honest. So I feel like that's another one where you can, depending on where you are in life and the more mature you are and what your current relationship status is, probably impacts the way you view the message.
Well, and not to like get super philosophical and detract from this film, I think that's what the consumption of art is about, right? Like the recurring consumption of art and the recurring consumption of film is about, how does this inform who I am at this moment in my life? And so every single time I've watched a film, it's been a different experience. So you think about the first moment of like your cold open of asking, what do I want to watch again? Like, I want to feel that joy I felt as a 13-year-old watching this movie that I loved and enjoyed and saw this world coming to life because it was joyful and it was fulfilling and it was this manifestation of a dream, right? And that is going to be a very different feeling if you watched that even for the first time at 12 or 15 or 20 or 30 or 40. And so I think the way you consume film and the way you consume art absolutely informs where you are in that moment and what's going on in your life and how mature you are and the relationships you've been in. And so I think in that way, it's a conversational experience and really interesting. So yeah, I think this is a good one to rewatch for that reason.
That was very deep. I feel like if we make a preview trailer for the podcast, we should just have that speech and then we'll tack on me saying like, and I'm here for comic relief. The end. Listen to We Drink and We Watch Things.
This is our new trailer for the pod. You are welcome.
I like Transformers and Dawn of the Dead. That's okay.
It's important to have balance. This film has shown us this.
Yes. Yeah. The last thing I wanted to call out before we get to ratings, just because we did kind of knock a little bit of, I mean, I don't know how much of it is pretentiousness and how much of it is just that this is a 20-year-old movie at this point.
Yeah.
We knocked some of the visuals, but I don't want to take away from just how incredibly creative some of the others are. I love the transition pieces where we're sort of cutting from memory to memory in the dream state. There's a lot of really cool segues when he's walking through the bookstore at the very beginning, but then he ends up back in his friend's living room.
Yep.
So they find very creative and, again, practical ways of telling this story that I think are neat.
I liked the transition from the sink to the car and he's wet, you know,
soaking wet. Yeah.
And I liked actually another like car, the transition in the drive-in theater thing too, where like it's things are disappearing behind them. The disappearing behind them I thought was very cool in multiple
the Grand
scenes.
Central Station shot where like everything.
Yeah. And that's like, oh God, anytime you shoot in Grand Central, like I'm a sucker for that. I'm like, what are we doing in Grand Central? It's so fun. Anyway, but like they do just, yeah, I agree. There are some really great shots here. There's some things that do feel a little overused, but also again, we have to think about like, this was something we were maybe playing with for the first time too. So I agree with that. So anyway, all that to say, definitely worth a rewatch, but what would you give it as a rating? What would you say?
Ooh, I hadn't actually thought of my numeric rating until now. I think I
Me
said
either,
last,
which is why yeah. I think it's great that I always get to ask that because I get a minute to think about it. So ready, go.
And it's funny because you always say gut, or at least when we started, you used to always say like gut check. Like it's not fair that I have to go first if you're the one doing
it. To be fair,
check.
While you're talking, I don't think okay. about it. I just gut check after you're done.
Thank you for being a good active listener. I said it last week. I think this might be in my top five films. It's definitely top 10, but it might crack my top five. Just a great fucking movie.
You know Lamar and his love of horror and the things that we talk about here all the time, like that is groundbreaking information for me as your podcast partner of over a year. I'm like, really? But I love that for you.
The first four are Cabin in the Woods, so don't get too
obviously,
excited.
Obviously.
But I would... Do I think it's perfect? I think I've only given out 1/10 the entire time we've done this pod. Maybe I think I gave out a 9.8 for something. Do I think this film is perfect? I don't think it's perfect.
We need to start documenting that. That's a great question.
We could probably backtrack and make a spreadsheet at some point. I think this is like a 9.5 for me. I don't know that there's a lot I would change. I think you can be unsatisfied with the ending or unhappy. But I don't think you can, like, I don't know how else you write that of just do they end up saying like, oh, well, we know this ends badly. Mm-hmm. So like, bye. Nice meeting you. That wouldn't be satisfying either.
No, it wouldn't be satisfying. I think that's a great call out.
Yeah. Setting aside that it came out in 2004, I think knocks out a couple of the weaker spots for me. But I just think it's so fucking good. I will say it takes from the opening credits. It takes a second to really kick in.
Take
I'm trying
off,
to remember.
Yeah.
But after like 10 minutes, it's just kind of balls to the wall after that. So I'm going to go 9.5. I think I'm pretty content with that. Yeah.
Damn, y'all. That is groundbreaking for you. I feel like now I want to literally go back and find all of our ratings for every single app because I'm very curious how that
I feel like I've hardly even given out that many nines.
I don't think
and
so.
If I'm being honest, I feel like this if you talk to me on the right day, this would probably be a 9 instead of a 9.5.
I feel like you do a lot of 6 to 7s. I feel like you. Mm. I feel like you're a solid
right
6 to 7er until we're really mad, and then you're a 4 to 5er.
6 to 7 is my. I watched this film. I had an okay time. That's
I had an okay time.
Seven.
You should watch it.
You can watch. Yeah, you should watch it. I'm not saying you're gonna love it. That's my 6-7 rating.
A 5 is like a 5 and above is like you should watch it, and a 5 or like a below 5 is like you should absolutely not watch it. Do not fucking waste your time. So at least for me.
Yeah.
Okay. So speaking for myself, gut check. I think this is an 8 for me.
Okay.
I think if I gut check, I think this is an 8, maybe an 8.5. I do get a little tired, like I said, of certain shots. I do think it drags a couple moments for me.
Yeah,
I know
that's
you said
fair.
Like, I know you were like, it's kind of balls to the wall. And it is conceptually balls to the wall, but it kind of drags for me. I also feel like the Mary Howard situation is so brief and not fleshed out enough for me to have a lot of investment in it. And for me to have a lot of emotional buy-in to her going to fucking burn everything to the ground the way that she does. And I've read some trivia about like what some of her backstory might be. So in that backstory scenario, I'm like, makes so much more sense. But the limited lens that we are given in this context and this version, her reaction feels extreme to me.
I think that's fair. They probably could have, and I think if they were going to remake this movie now, or if they started production on it now, they would probably give her character more screen time overall.
I think she needs it.
If you're to, make to have land. That, to have yeah. her be sort of the impetus for them she getting control, these tapes.
She impacts yeah. so much action. She impacts so much forward motion in the story. Yeah.
I do enjoy the sort of twist of she has been white, like this place she yes. works at, and it's been this relationship with her supervisor, and it's happened at least once that we know of before. Right. So I think it logically makes sense, and I think it is a pretty good twist, but I feel like because we spend so much time with Joel, mm-hmm. we don't get as much time with Mary as we probably, and all of the outside, I feel like they could have made right. Elijah Wood, maybe if this movie were, it's the rare case where I'm going to say this movie could have been a little longer, like add 10 minutes, yes. 15.
Because it's less than 2 hours. I agree. Yeah. It's less than 2 hours. So you could add in, I think you could actually, if you wanted to keep it the exact same length, you could remove some Patrick time and you could add some Mary Howard time, or at least enough to give backstory, right? Of like make you really bought into that, or keep it with Patrick's time as it is and add some Mary Howard background and get it rounded out at 2 hours. And yeah, I would be more bought into that scenario.
The only risk you run though, if they were to add that, is apparently we hear talk of the character of Naomi throughout this, of Joel's current girlfriend when he meets Clementine. Yes. And that was cast. They filmed scenes with Ellen Pompeo from Grey's Anatomy before she got Grey's Anatomy. She was going to be in this film. And they cut it for time, or just, I guess, didn't think it added anything to the story. But apparently Joel was going to have a one-night stand with her during his yeah. relationship with Clem. I feel like that takes, again, away from the happiness of their relationship, quote-unquote.
I think that would fuck this up, to be honest. Yeah, and I read that, too. I think that would fuck this up the way that it is. I think you keep it on the people that are here and just develop it a little bit more. And I think that's a writing thing. And again, I think it's still very strong. I think it's an 8, 8.5. I just think
there was one other role. Did you read the other person who was filmed some scenes for this, but did not make it past the cutting room? Tracy Morgan.
I did not read
Tracy
that.
Tracy Morgan was going to be Joel's neighbor. I believe they filmed some scenes, but again, all the scenes got cut.
That's a homie trying to help out a homie. You know what I mean? That's a like, hey, I love working with this guy. Let's see what we can do in this movie. No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. What that was a good decision, guys.
I want the Tracy Morgan cut. He gets.
I mean, I
want to
see it. I just don't want it to be the version that we all have to watch on repeat. But I do want to. I want to see the deleted scenes. I was that kid who religiously. Why do y'all think I have 5,000 copies of DVDs? Okay, I would watch the deleted scenes on all of them. So. Let's get some deleted scenes, Tracy. All right, homies. Well, thanks for joining. We went hard on that one. That was a good time, though. So thank you for joining us. I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as we did. Come back next week for our second to last entry. And we're going to be talking about Ready or Not, which
is... This is your first time watching this movie?
This was my first time watching it. And no spoilers, but I wasn't disappointed. I will say that.
Yeah, I enjoy it. It's not a perfect film, but if you're like me and you saw the trailer and were like, a horror movie about hide and seek, that's fucking stupid. And then I watched it. So go watch it before next week.
Also, can we talk about how that was your reaction? I expected you to be like, when I saw a trailer about a horror movie about hide and seek, and I was like, fuck yes. Like,
now, if they make one about hungry, hungry hippos, I'm in. That I will not fucking hesitate. You know, Mousetrap, give me that movie.
Wow. Yeah. Because I definitely had that reaction of like, is this a horror movie about a game? You guys are fucking idiots. And I did not want to watch it at all. I acquiesced a little in this particular selection, but I can admit when I'm wrong. And I had an interesting time. I had a good time. So come back for that one. But in the meantime.
In the meantime, follow us on our socials. We drink and we watch things, mostly Instagram, sometimes TikTok. You can also watch us now on Spotify video or on YouTube. So if you're missing out on the beauty of our drinks or the lack of beauty in some cases when we mess the recipes up, sorry, Skylar, you can see that on YouTube or Spotify. And then don't be afraid to email us. We drink and we watch things pod@gmail.com with feedback, episode suggestions, things that we fucked up.
Shit talking.
Disagreements. Yeah, eventually I feel like we'll probably do another email episode when we're short on ideas. So yeah.
If you hang out on YouTube, all they do is talk shit. So feel free to go there if you're wanting to talk some shit, to be honest. But but for now, go have a drink and watch a thing. Cheers.
Cheers. I said at the beginning that my goal was to do a shot of this, and now I'm basically going to end up doing a shot of this.
Do it. Okay, I'm chugging too. Is it going to slurp? Let's see.
Oh, yeah, you slurped it.
Slurp that bitch. Whew. Whew.